From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, the 14th of September, 2020. We have a good show lined up for you today. We're going to get an update on where things stand on cannabis-related legislation as lawmakers enter their home stretch of this strange session, stretching into September, as it almost never does. They're still there, still working, and we're going to get an update on where they are on cannabis legislation from Matt Simon of the Marijuana Policy Project. He is a supporter of the bills the legislature is considering, so keep that in mind as you hear what he has to say, but he's also very well informed and thoughtful on this topic. In the second half hour of the, well, let me first tell you, in the latter hour, we're going to be speaking with Tabitha Moore. She is founder of the NAACP chapter in the Rutland area and an activist on racial justice issues here in Vermont, and has run into some harassment, unfortunately, where she lives in Wallingford. Her daughter wanted to get a Black Lives Matter flag raised at the high school, that Mill River Union High School, that was became quite controversial in that community, and Ms. Moore says some harassment has resulted. We're going to be talking with her about how she's responding to that. It sounds like a pretty tough time. We'll be hearing all about that in the second hour of the program. In that interim period from about 9:35 to 10, we're going to be speaking with Jay Shepherd. He was a delegate to the Republican National Convention. He comes from Essex, very active in Republican politics, and is a big supporter of President Trump. We wanted to get someone of that viewpoint on our air to talk about some of the recent developments. Certainly the president has had a bit of a bumpy ride in the last couple of weeks with revelations in The Atlantic and other media about comments he made about people serving who have served in our military. And then, of course, last week, the news about Bob Woodward's book coming out, quoting the president in recorded interviews with Mr. Woodward, talking about how he was intentionally downplaying the coronavirus back in February and March. And so, but I wanted to get to someone who's a supporter of the president, just to sort of ask them to give their thoughts on what all this means, if anything. And Jay Shepherd is bravely willing to step up. I appreciate that. We'll be talking with him, as I mentioned, between about 9:35 and 10. But let's get ready to our first scheduled conversation this morning. That's with Matt Simon of the Marijuana Policy Project. I believe he's on the phone with us right now. Good morning, Matt. Thanks for joining me.
Dave, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to do it. So give me an update now. I've been trying to keep up the VT Digger and other outlets, but, you know, following the bouncing ball when you're not actually under the dome is sometimes a little difficult. What is going on with the, first off, with the bill that would set up a retail cannabis marketing system in Vermont?
Sure. So I don't think anybody's really under the dome at this point, but there's a lot happening via Zoom.
Under the bubble, let's call it now, yeah.
Yeah, right. I guess it's still the bubble, figuratively, but this mm-hmm. is all. Anybody can watch any committee. It's really amazing how the staff has figured out how to make Zoom democracy work in Vermont. So I've been watching mm-hmm. YouTube streams of all the relevant committees, and it's been fascinating. So two bills, really. Since football started, I have to use a football metaphor. There are two bills inside the five-yard line that are cannabis-related. One of them, I'd say, is inside the one-yard line. It's like first and goal from inside the one on the bill that would automatically expunge past records for cannabis possession. So folks may know that Vermont decriminalized possession back in 2013 and legalized it in 2018. But people may not know that there are still thousands of Vermonters who have criminal record for past low-level possession offenses. And this is especially a problem for black and brown Vermonters who have been arrested at much higher rates over the years, despite using cannabis at the same rate as white Vermonters. So a few of Vermont's state's attorneys have hosted expungement clinics trying to help people get their records removed. Nonprofits such as the Pennywise Foundation have stepped up and helped try to cover some of the fees, but it isn't enough, and the legislature has finally come together on the idea that nobody should have to go through that process, that if you have a criminal record for behavior that is now legal in Vermont, that the state should go through and eliminate those records, and it should be like it never happened. So that's S-234. It's passed the Senate. It passed the House on Friday. There's another procedural vote, I think, tomorrow. But that appears that is going to become law and be really a step forward on the criminal justice policy front. Of course, the other bill...
Is your understanding that Governor Phil Scott is on board?
I don't know that he has been asked about this bill specifically, but it has passed the Senate by an overwhelming, I believe, margin, and it passed the House 113-10. So it seems like overwhelming support in the legislature, and I have no idea about the governor, but hope he would sign it. And the other bill is certainly much more uncertain in its fate. It's, I'd say, inside the five-yard line, and the House and Senate have been talking about how should we regulate and tax cannabis sales for 5 years now. It's been really a lot of time spent studying it and deliberating it, and the House and Senate this year finally come together almost entirely on a bill that would move Vermont forward with regulated adult-use sales. So there's a committee of conference that has resolved most of its issues between the House and Senate versions of this bill, and they still are talking about the local tax issues, and they've narrowed it down to a tiny number of issues that they still haven't reached consensus on. But hopefully this week that the House and Senate will finally agree, and that bill will, after another vote in each chamber, go to the governor's desk, and that's the one that... He may need some encouragement to sign. Last thing he said was taking a wait-and-see approach. So I think they're open to it, waiting to see what comes out.
One thing the governor has said pretty consistently in the past about this is he wants to see some kind of a roadside testing regimen on the theory that, you know, police can stop you for suspicion of drunken driving, give you a breathalyzer test, even a blood test if that seems to be warranted. And people have been looking around for a kind of a parallel system for cannabis and other substances. What's the status of that whole part of the debate?
Sure. So that's something the House and Senate have agreed to, and they reached a compromise on that, particularly in light of, you know, this discussion all took place before the current pandemic that we're in. And when you say the words roadside saliva test now, I think it brings an image to people's mind of police officers sticking their hands in somebody's mouth at the side of the road, and that isn't an appeal police or to anybody else. But prior to that, the House had amended this provision. They passed a version of it, but not a roadside test. It would be similar. It would enable a saliva test, but the police officer would have to obtain a search warrant before administering it, and it could not be administered roadside. They'd have to take you back to the barracks and administer the test, and that's the process that they have for blood now. It requires a warrant, and you know, it would be treated similarly. And it's, you know, there are a lot of issues with saliva testing. It's not accurate in terms of, it can't be accurate in terms of telling you who's impaired or who isn't. It can tell you whether somebody's used cannabis recently, but, you know, a person shouldn't be convicted ever solely on the basis of a saliva test, and the provision in the bill would not allow people to be convicted solely on that basis. It would be the totality of the circumstances, which is how Vermont's DUI laws operate generally. A person can't be impaired to the slightest degree by any substance, and it's the totality of the circumstances that results in a conviction.
And one of the sort of corollary debates here or something over the years has been this question about if you have some THC or its metabolites in your system, in other words, you have evidence in your blood or your saliva of having smoked or otherwise ingested cannabis recently, the question then comes to how recently, because I know that some of the metabolites can last for weeks in your body and without having any impairing effect after, you know, the immediate day you might have ingested cannabis. And so there's, you know, one of the things that the defense side of this whole situation will tell you is that there's plenty of potential for false positives based on cannabis use sometime, you know, several days or weeks earlier. Has that ever been resolved, or are the tests getting more finely tuned, or where are we on that?
Yeah, I wish I could give you a simple answer. The technology and the science is certainly advancing, but in when it comes to this issue, this is something the legislature has taken many hours of testimony on from law enforcement, from policy experts. They've been trying to craft a balance, as with all of these other sub-issues that come up with cannabis legalization. You know, they've had to reach a compromise. They've had to balance public safety versus civil liberties. Similarly, they've heard testimony from doctors, some of whom have been on your program, talking about potency and things like that. They've tried to compromise with people who have expressed concerns. And, you know, there are other people on the other side who say, we want cannabis to be regulated similarly to tomatoes. Anybody should be able to grow it and sell it. There shouldn't be any regulations. It's just a plant. Why are we bothering with this? And the legislature is in a tough position trying to craft policy that compromises and makes the most sense for Vermont, given the wide disparity of opinions that people still have about cannabis. I think we've reached a lot of consensus on the idea that it shouldn't be illegal, and Vermonters should be able to go buy it at a store. They shouldn't have to drive to Massachusetts to buy it. It's just silly from every perspective, but a lot of these issues, there have had to be compromises, and Bill, I won't say it's perfect, but I really respect the work that's gone into it, and it absolutely would move Vermont in what I see as a good direction.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to buy cannabis at retail right now, I guess you can drive down to any one of several places in Massachusetts and find yourself a shop to go into and buy it. I mean, if you're assuming you're an adult and you can do that. And is there much activity in terms of, I mean, I can't imagine it would be, because police have more important things to do. But, I mean, anybody being followed from, you know, Greenfield back to Brattleboro and busted when they crossed the Vermont state line?
Well, I haven't heard any cases of that happening. There are three retail stores within 15 miles of Vermont's southern border. Anecdotally, I've heard that there are Vermont license plates in those parking lots pretty much all the time. So Vermonters are taking advantage of the retail system in Massachusetts, spending their money in Massachusetts and paying their taxes in Massachusetts. And they're coming back, and I haven't heard any cases of people being busted. I think Vermont law enforcement has much more important things to do than go fishing at the border for the existence of a substance that's legal in Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. At least in small amounts. Now, I mean, that actually points up one of the anomalies in our legalization law, where it's legal to have the stuff in Vermont. It's just not legal to buy it technically in Vermont, right? Or sell it.
That's
so
exactly
therefore.
It. So yeah. Yeah. People have to fend for themselves. And you know, if you happen to own your own home, you happen to have space to cultivate, then you can grow your own, and that's terrific. But
yep.
Most Vermonters, like most beer drinkers, don't want to brew their own. Most cannabis consumers don't want to grow their own. And a lot of people rent, you know, and rental agreements don't tend to allow cultivation. So we have to have some kind of retail market. It's the only sensible policy.
And as the legislation is currently pending and, you know, up for discussion between the House and the Senate this week, tell me about the system that you envision it setting up. Would there be big differences or even small differences between sort of the Massachusetts retail environment and the Vermont retail environment? Anything that comes to mind as I'll give you one example of with alcohol. Okay. Mm-hmm. If I go to Yankee Spirits in Montpelier, they actually have alcohol, you know, spirits, liquors. They have wines and beers and snacks, you know, and et cetera. Mm-hmm. If you go to a New Hampshire state liquor store, I think they sell spirits, liquors, and wines, but they don't sell beer and they don't sell any food.
Right.
And it's just sort of this odd difference that, you know, clearly is codified in state law somewhere, that in one state the stores can do this and the other. I mean, so that's the kind of stylistic difference I'm interested in now. What would you see there, if anything?
Well, I don't think Vermont should start taking its cues from New Hampshire on cannabis policy anytime soon or anything else necessarily.
Yep.
But I think there are some really key differences that people should know about. One of the biggest concerns and complaints I hear online is, isn't this bill just setting up corporate cannabis? Aren't we going to have big companies come in and take over the thing? And that's something that has been heard at every public hearing on this issue, and legislators have heard it over and over again. And what they've done is created regulatory policies in this bill that seek to prevent that from happening. No business in Vermont would be allowed to have more than one license of any type. So you can have one cultivation license, you can have one retail license. But you can't have two retail outlets. Massachusetts allows each entity to have up to three, so they're at least, it's somewhat more appealing to a big company that wants to have multiple stores. But in Vermont, they prioritized small-scale cultivator licenses. The bills requires regulators to prioritize licensing for small cultivators, for women and minority-owned businesses, really just trying to create an equitable market from the very beginning, seeing that that hasn't always happened in some of the first states that legalized. And, you know, we've been talking for years, what's the Vermont way? How do we legalize cannabis the Vermont way? And I think that this bill is, for better or worse, it reflects the opinions of hundreds of Vermonters who have expressed themselves throughout this process over the course of 5 years and decisions made by the legislature.
And Matt Simon, I'm curious to know if you think the on the retail side of this thing, what's your bet? Will Vermont end up with by sometime in 2021 with a place to go to do your cannabis shopping?
Dave, I'm going to dodge that question just as hard as I can, because I like to bet on things. If mm-hmm. I feel like I have, if I know what the outcome is, reasonable.
Or at least have a feeling for it,
yeah. This one could absolutely go either way, and, you know, it's going to depend on the details of what gets done. It's going to depend on it getting done. There's still some chance that the legislators don't reach final agreement. They're still talking about the tax issues and how municipalities should be funded through the taxation. The Senate bill has a 2% local option tax included in it, and the House doesn't want that. So or maybe it's the other way around. I keep getting confused. But the question is, how do municipalities get money out of this? And the Vermont League of Cities and Towns has been very active in this process, you know, first opposing this, and then sort of as it became clear that it was going to happen, they've taken the position that we want to make sure cities and towns are getting a lot of the revenue one way or another. So that's still unresolved. You know, people want this to happen. Call your legislators and tell them this matters. Vermont needs these jobs, this tax revenue, this economic stimulus that will come from passing this bill. So dot the I's, cross the T's, figure out a final version of this bill that makes the most sense and send it forward to the governor's desk. And then it's a matter of prevailing on the governor that this is good policy and that this does move Vermont in a direction that it needs to go. So
the the bill is what's the number of the bill now on the retail sales? Is it
that's S-54?
I have seen a couple of postings online where people are complaining about this being some kind of a giveaway to big corporations or something. You feel like those issues have been taken care of in this? I mean, what are those complaints based on, and are they at all valid?
Yeah. Well, I've been dealing with a lot of those criticisms myself, and it's just, it's come to my, and the conclusion I've reached is that some people will describe any bill that allows regulated sales of cannabis as corporate weed or whatever, and will dismiss it as that no matter what the policy actually says. So again, the bill prioritizes small cultivators. It creates a small cultivation license up to 1,000 square feet. It strictly limits the ability of businesses to, you know, corner large parts of the market. You can only have one retail license. You can only have one license, and it requires disclosure of all the financing and all of the, you know, the money behind any business. So Vermonters, legislators have heard that concern repeatedly over the years, and I think when you listen to what these opponents of the bill are saying, you know, when you drill down on it, what they want is direct farm-to-consumer sales. They want to be able to just grow cannabis and sell it from farm stands without the kind of regulation that the legislature feels is necessary. And maybe someday that will be what Vermont does, but in the here and now, there are a lot of people who are concerned about public safety, concerned about teen use, and want to protect consumers with a regulated system. You know, the medical cannabis system in Vermont is still regulated by a law enforcement agency, you know, the Department of Public Safety. This bill will move it into the Cannabis Control Board, and there would be, for the first time ever, independent lab testing for medical cannabis in Vermont, something that should have had a very long time ago. So this is just a smarter way to regulate cannabis, both on the medical side and the adult use side, and it is an attempt to make policy that works for everybody in Vermont.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. Are there votes scheduled this week? Do you know anything about what's happening on that front?
Yeah, well, the expungement bill, I believe, has a final third reading vote in the House, and then it goes back to the Senate for concurrence and on to the governor. The committee of conference, to my knowledge, has not set a date for its hopefully final meeting. It has to be this week or next.
Because they're getting ready to wrap it up finally for the year.
So,
Matt Simon, we're about out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us this morning and giving us an update on all of this. We'll be keeping an eye out. Perhaps have you back to report again. Thank you very much. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news, and stay with us, folks. We're going to be talking with Jay Shepard, big supporter of President Trump, in the next half hour.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and I just want to introduce our next guest, actually. I was going to tell you a little story, but I said, nah, I'll save it for some other time. Let's see here. Our next guest is Jay Shepard. He was a Republican. He was a delegate, I should say, to the Republican National Convention last month, and he is a big supporter of President Trump. My sense is that President Trump has been having a bit of a bumpy ride last couple of weeks. A lot of people criticizing him over alleged remarks about our U.S. service members. He was the subject of a lot of coverage last week of this new book coming out from Bob Woodward about how the president said in on-the-record interviews that he intentionally downplayed the coronavirus, and that, of course, caused a lot of consternation. And so it occurred to me I should probably get a Trump defender or supporter on the show to say, just to sort of offer some a little bit of a defense argument for this stuff, because certainly the president, as I say, has been getting a lot of slings and arrows sent in his direction over the past couple weeks. Not to say for the first time, but seems to be a growing phenomenon, shall we say. Jay Shepard is joining me this morning by telephone. Jay, I really appreciate you your willingness to do so.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Dave. I think it's very nice that you have me on, and we can talk about not, you know, I don't like the word defending the president, because I think we want to talk about all the great accomplishments that have gone with it. And what I'm really trying to do is dispel these debunked stories about him that are very untrue and started actually, I think, the first attack on the president from the media and from the Democrats was at 12:09, 9 minutes after he became president. So it's nothing new, and it's really not a growing number of attacks. It's just coming from more and more directions, people saying the same things over and over that have been pretty well debunked at this point.
Well, do you remember, is there some specific attack you have in mind as to that 12:09 attack of the election night, 2016?
Well, they sent out, there was at 12:09, they sent out a thing saying, we now start to impeach the president. And that was, actually, there was an article in the Washington Post on their digital platform with attacks against the president and his administration at 12:09. So apparently they had planned this well in advance, and it goes back to all the lies about the Steele documents and those kind of things. And most recently, you know, the whole talk about the losers and suckers and all of that, when there's been well over two dozen people who were actually in France at the time that said it never happened. We can't find the name of anybody who said it did happen. So it's one of those little gossip and rumor things that go around where they've been working every day throwing something against the wall trying to take down this president, because this small group of people that hate him is trying to overcome the large group of us that really like what he's accomplishing and getting done. And it's been a phenomenal amount of accomplishments, and they don't want to allow anyone to hear those or to see those.
In the case of these alleged comments about the military, does it hurt though that they seem to fit a picture which, in for instance, when the president was on television being interviewed and was disparaging John McCain, talking about how he likes people who didn't get captured, etc., that sort of sounds like similar behavior, or that behavior and this behavior have some similarities that make it in some ways perhaps more credible. Do you think that hurts him?
Well, I think, you know, it was an unfortunate comment he made about John McCain. And I think there's a big difference between speaking about someone specifically and a group of people in general. And what the media has tried to do is they look for a weakness, they conspire with the liberals on the other side, and they keep bringing these stories up that have some basis of, I don't even want to say fact, but they have this foundation of what they've already passed out in the past. And when we talk about behavior, I think it's more important to talk about actions and what the president has done for the VA. All the changes that have taken place to modernize it and to give better health care to our veterans, ending wars that no president has ended in years and years, where the previous administration had 8 years to end wars and did not. President's bringing people home in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he really has been a great president for our veterans. So it's a lot better, I think, to talk about accomplishments and deeds that are actually done, rather than talking about words here and there.
The Washington Post talks about a long history of disparaging military service, and I mean, I guess that's some of what I'm pointing at in terms of it would have been more surprising if some story had come out saying that he had been making lots of comments behind the scenes in praise of the troops and talking about them as heroes and so on and so forth. Because again, I think some of what or many people will look at a piece of news coming out and they sort of see whether it fits in a picture that has previously been established in their minds to some extent. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And the sad part is that the media, along with the office holders on the other side, have worked very hard at creating a narrative that is constantly criticizing the president. So what they do is they build this false narrative out there, and then they bring out these little tidbits and these little facts that are totally one-sided. So they're really creating a narrative that they can harp on in order to disparage this president. They don't spend a lot of time talking about the increase in pay that he's pushed for the military, increased health benefits that active duty. My son-in-law is an active duty naval officer, and the benefits in the upside in the last 3 years alone have been tremendous for him and my family because of that. So they want to create this negative uncertainty out there about this president without any balance at all. And I think the Washington Post is one of the worst offenders there is, where they create this narrative and then they pound and pound. And then the other thing that really bothers me, Dave, and I don't know if it bothers you like it does me, but it's reporters reporting on reporters. Instead of having actual people come through and put their name on things, they start quoting other news sources rather than actually doing the hard work of bringing out real news.
One thing I sometimes say to folks who are complaining about the media being too negative, remember that And I actually saw some writing over the weekend concerning the case of the 5-year-old North Carolina boy who happened to be white who was shot by a man who happened to be black, and comments about how the national media were not covering this story and so on. One of the things that I think people forget is that when things proceed sort of in an expected or normal fashion, as in when military folks occasionally get pay raises, everybody, you hope, occasionally gets a pay raise. We have inflation in this country. You want salaries to keep up. So that's not, frankly, as big a story as something weird happening. I think I've told folks before that who complain about the media being too negative, I'll say, well, the day you see a headline that says plane lands safely, that's the day you really need to start worrying about aviation. And by the way, on that morning in December of 1903, when the Wright brothers landed their plane safely at Kitty Hawk, you can bet there were headlines about plane land safely. So,
yeah.
I think.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm kind of worried. We've seen all the pullback and the cutbacks in the media, and I think. I used to think that, sometimes the media was a little lazy and they didn't do all the homework. But I think with the limited resources you're seeing the media having these days, mm-hmm. that it's much easier just to create commentary and use other people's reporting than it is to do the hard work. I mean, we've seen it here in Vermont where media sources, where they laid off very talented journalists because of financial reasons. And I think you're seeing that all over the country. And we're seeing too much of the political, and it's a little bit on both parts, where they're reading press releases and they're going through the narratives and things that are given to them, rather than doing the hard work of reporting a balance and having information that Americans really need. And it's a little disappointing.
Let's bring in a listener who's on the line. Ruth from Sheldon is calling. Hey, good morning, Ruth.
Yes, I think this would be a good opportunity for me to say that I am very grateful for President Trump for what he is doing for VA benefits for veterans. We have benefited by this greatly, to the tune of thousands and thousands of dollars, because somebody in my family was able to use the Choices for Care and go in our own neighborhood to get medical care, which we didn't have any insurance for, which I have complained about for decades that we didn't have insurance. But President Trump made sure that our family member was able to get VA benefits, and he's able to get Choices for Care. And I am very happy with the care he has been receiving. Thank you.
That's great, Ruth. Thank you for the call. So Choices for Care, there's a positive story. And I have seen some discussion of that in the media. I guess there is a tendency, again, I was just saying that the news media tend to point out, I've seen definitions in journalism textbooks and so on, that news oftentimes contains at least an element of something which is unusual, you know, something which is actually new. It hadn't happened previously, or at least it hadn't happened on a routine basis. And does that skew things? Do you think, Jay Shepard?
Well, I absolutely agree. And news, you know, is really important. But there's also a need for it to be factual. You know, rumor and innuendo is not news. It's gossip. And if you don't start reporting the news and what's truthful, then people lose faith in the entire process. And we need the media out there. We need people reporting news and doing the stories that need to be done. You know, I want to go back to Ruth and what she said in Sheldon. You know, Sheldon's a long ways from the VA hospital in White River Junction. And they do a very good job down there at the VA hospital in White River Junction. But the CARES Act, Choices for Care really makes a big difference, especially in Vermont, where we're rural and we don't have opportunities where we can start accessing local doctors and local hospitals. And I wish there would be more that are brought out, and I thank you for that call.
In terms of actually, you know, you want more reliance on facts. I want to turn the page here to this story that broke this past week concerning some recorded on the record interviews with the President of the United States, these by Bob Woodward, longtime journalist with the Washington Post, now mainly a writer of books, and in fact, purely a writer of books, I guess, these days. Anyway, are you happier with that kind of coverage than with stuff that's based on anonymous sources and that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's important to talk about Bob Woodward and his access to the president and all of that. And I think if you look back on the history, Bob Woodward has not been overly friendly or encouraging to presidents in either party. And the fact that our president would give him access the way he did, I think, needs to be applauded for his openness and his willingness to talk about people who do some in-depth reporting. So I don't want to totally downplay or criticize Bob Woodward's work. I think there's a difference in his book where he makes conclusions based on some interviews. And I think we look at a large book of several hundred pages, and the content that's been publicly made is kind of interesting in their choices.
You'd have to assume that something related to the coronavirus would be. In other words, imagine yourself as a reporter. You've been given an assignment to look this book over and figure out what the most newsworthy nuggets in it, and you see some material in there related to the coronavirus. Is that going to be elevated in your interest because it's been clearly the number one story of 2020?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's really important. And some of the things that Mr. Woodward said were really important. And the president did come out and admit that he downplayed in public. Wow, my mouth's not working. Downplayed in public the seriousness of the pandemic. But one of the things that they didn't talk about, especially on the 60 Minutes interview last night, is they never talked about the fact that in the administration, they never downplayed the effects. So his response was not downplayed. His verbalness to stop panic in the streets from the pandemic was very, very important. So the way that he handled it, in saying that we should not be panicking and that it's not going to kill the 2 million people that the media had actually said were going to die in this pandemic. Now, you know, if you want to look at it that way, they predicted 2 million deaths in America, and so he saved, what is it, a million eight people in this country by not having the panic in how he played the pandemic. So there's a big difference between downplaying it verbally and what the administration immediately did in January to fight this virus. He shut down our borders, stopped China from coming to this country. He took a tremendous amount of incoming for his response in closing our borders. But yet they want to talk about how he downplayed the seriousness of it, maybe verbally to keep people calm so we don't have more deaths than we need. But the administration jumped in almost immediately to start taking action to stop this from spreading as best they could.
Who predicted 2 million coronavirus deaths?
That came from the WHO. And it's kind of interesting how the WHO, you know, they have one job to do, and that's to protect the world from these spreading pandemics. And they failed miserably, and I think it's great that they were finally, you know, losing some of their funding for being inadequate in one of the most important times for them to step up. So it was the WHO that had predicted the 2 million deaths that were coming, and it was reported widely back in March of this year. So I want to really give the president credit for really saving all these lives. And if we get away from some of the metro areas where there was panic and they started sending COVID patients in with senior citizens in nursing homes, you have to really applaud the president, and not just the president, but the whole administration, for taking this seriously and getting things done in a way that has saved lives.
I'm looking at a report from Cato.org. The Cato Institute, of course, is a, I think fair to say, right-leaning libertarian think tank. And it attributes this $2.2 million lives lost estimate not to the WHO, but actually to Neil Ferguson and a team at Imperial College London. Dr. Ferguson, it says, had previously publicized almost equally sensational death estimates from mad cow disease, bird flu, and swine flu. So apparently this guy has a record of overstating the deaths from various contagious diseases. The New York Times quickly ran the news about this new COVID-19 estimate. The report, which warned that an uncontrolled spread of the disease could cause as many as 510,000 deaths in Britain, triggered a sudden shift in the government's comparatively relaxed response to the virus. American officials said the report, which projected up to 2.2 million deaths in the United States from such a spread, also influenced the White House to strengthen its measures to isolate members of the public. There has been quite a bit in the United States, although not as much as some people would like, of mask wearing, social distancing, et cetera. Is this, do you think that perhaps we have reduced the numbers of the deaths that were possible from the coronavirus through these practices?
Oh, absolutely. I think the sad part is that the so-called experts, the scientists that we were listening to early on, were giving conflicting reports. I don't know if you remember how initially they were saying, don't wear masks, don't buy masks. Then they were saying, buy masks. Then they were talking social distancing. They weren't sure if it was spreading on surfaces or where it was spreading. I know early on, you know, I was doing sanitary wipes when I went to the post office to open the doors. And so it hasn't spread. So we had all these mixed reports out there that everybody suddenly was an expert. And I think one of the telling things that Bob Woodward said last night, because he knew on February 7th that it was bad, that the president told him in that interview that it could be very bad, but he never reported it either. And when he was asked why he didn't report it and he didn't spread the word, he said because there were so many conflicting other stories about it. And I think if you go back in January, February, and March, there were so many conflicting stories that it was tough to know exactly what to do because we're hearing so many different views on it. And I think if you look at where the president and the administration took it, they're very cautious in terms of not spreading the, you know, the 2 million people. They were not talking about panic in the streets. So they downplayed it a little bit in public because there was no definitive scientific evidence of the right way to handle it and the right way to deal with it. So I'm very happy with how they worked on that, especially when they had so many conflicting views from the so-called science experts.
Jay, I expect that I know the answer you're going to give me, but I have to ask anyway. What's your prediction for the outcome in November? The president is lagging in some of the polls, but is he going to pull it out?
Without a doubt. I think if you look at where he was 4 years ago at this same point, he's so far ahead in the poll that he not only will hold all the states that he won last time, he will gain four additional states and win by a larger margin.
He'll win by a larger margin than he did in 2016. Do you think that the election will go off smoothly, or is it going to be a delayed count? And some of the forecasts are not real positive there.
If they continue to have these what I call mail-out ballots, you know, we've been very happy with the absentee ballots and how they work, but when you mail ballots out, there's such an opportunity for fraud and mistake and general errors and doing something new. So I'm very worried about how it will all come out and all the different recordings of it. And, you know, I just wish we could get back to the way voting is supposed to be, where you go and you vote on the day that the elections are, unless you need an absentee ballot.
It's about all the time we have. I appreciate your chipping in with us this morning, Jay Shepherd. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Dave. Thank you, and have
fun. Coming up on the 10 o'clock CBS News, we'll have words from one of our CBS correspondents and then continue with the Dave Graham Show following. Stay with us, folks.
This is WDEV News Radio, owned and operated by the Radio Vermont Group. From the top of Sugar Bush, 96.1 WDEV FM, Warren and Waitsfield, 96.5 W243 Barrie, 98.3 W252 CU Montpelier, along with our founding station, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. Streaming at WDEVradio.com. 89 years of serving Vermont. The friendly pioneer, WDEV.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
Thanks for staying with us into our second hour of this Monday morning program, September the 14th, 2020, and really happy to have all you listeners out there. And please don't be shy if you want to call in and tell us what's going on in your life, or just tell us whatever our daily commentary is great or off the rails or whatever you want to say. We're always happy to take your calls at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Let's bring in Leonard Steinhorn, CBS political analyst, and I believe he's on the phone with us. Good morning, Leonard.
Good morning to you. Happy to be here.
And lots going on, as one might expect, just 50 days to go, I guess, before the presidential election. A couple questions. One is, does any of these big stories that have broken in the last couple of weeks, the Atlantic thing about the military disparagement alleged by the president allegedly engaging in this, any big changes likely as a result of Bob Woodward's recorded interviews with the president where he acknowledges downplaying the coronavirus? What's your sense?
Well, look, we have to think that the basis, the strong supporters of each party, they're pretty baked in. This is not going to affect any of Donald Trump's supporters. When you saw some of the Woodward stuff, breaking on Fox News, there were a lot of excuses and a lot of justifications and a lot of mitigation. So that wasn't breaking through a lot. The key thing is there aren't a lot of undecided voters. There aren't a lot of voters in the middle. But if there are even 5% of people who haven't made up their minds, and if these stories do have an impact, they could make a difference in those key battleground states, 6 or 7 of them, that will decide the future of our country. So bottom line is this, those stories could have an impact. The cumulative effect of the sense that the president hasn't been straight with the American people, that he's had contempt for American heroes, that he downplayed something that if he had actually brought it to the attention of people might have saved lives, that could have an impact on perceptions of his character, leadership, and credibility. And if it influences that small slice of voters in those states that could go one way or the other, or that are soft for Biden, become stronger for Biden, soft for Trump, become more undecided, those stories could have an impact. But again, we don't know this because we only have polls, and polls are imperfect. Remember one thing about a poll. They could say that 43% of voters support President Trump, but in the footnote is what's called the margin of statistical error, plus or minus 3 or 4% or something like that, and that could bump his 43 up to 47 or 48.
Yep. And, of course, even that is not 100% certain, right? Isn't it 95% certain that you fall in the margin of error, I think, if I remember
correct. Yeah, it's like, it's a bell curve.
Grad school.
So, bottom line, I don't want to jump out of my apartment building on a 95% certainty that I'm going to be caught. You know, it's just something that we, you know, it's informative, it's helpful. You do trust some of these people who are the best in their field. But the very fact that it's only 95% certain, that it's maybe plus or minus 3 or 3.5%, that doesn't give you the greatest amount of confidence to be able to predict the future.
Yep. And although I am betting on the Celtics in the series against Miami. Not to say that they're anyway, sports is anywhere near as important as the future conduct of our country. But anyway. Hey,
I always quote Yogi Berra, who says, I never make predictions, especially about the future.
Especially about the future. That's right.
Yeah. That's
Yogi
Berra, right?
I love Yogi Berra's stuff. He's pretty, lots of good, funny stuff. And your thoughts about, I'm curious what you think about this Woodward dust up, where he's catching some flack from people for not having reported earlier on the statements by President Trump that he apparently has had since February and March.
Well, I think those are good, legitimate questions. Look, Woodward says that given the president's track record where you don't know whether what he's saying is true or not, you want to be careful about whether you disclose that information if you don't have it verified. But once he did get it verified, once he did find out that the president did indeed get a national security briefing at the end of January, which is apparently what the president was referring to in his February 7th conversation with Woodward, does Woodward have a responsibility to go out there? Well, look, he's a journalist. He's not a public official. But at the same time, as a journalist, finding information out that is relevant to the people of our country, perhaps he does. And who knows if that could have changed the trajectory, if it would have put the president a little bit more on the defensive. Because the president could argue, look, I didn't want to panic people. Of course, you don't have to, if you disclose information, it doesn't mean you'll panic people. It depends on how you disclose it and what leadership you exert. But by March 13th or 10th, people were already panicking. You know, the president was calling people back from overseas, and you had airports and cities throughout the world where Americans were packed in, desperately trying to come home, paying 5 times the ticket price for a coach seat to be able to come back to the United States at that moment in time. New York was in shutdown and in crisis, so that wouldn't be panicking. So if Woodward had come out with it and put the president a little bit on the defensive for knowing about this, maybe the president would have doubled down on his leadership earlier, more decisively, encouraged more people to wear masks, since the president knew that this was airborne as early as the end of January. So it's very possible that Woodward saying this could have impacted the trajectory of this disease and therefore potentially have saved lives. Now, again, Woodward is not a public official. He's a journalist. And so it's, you know, he doesn't have a responsibility to the American people through his oath of office to be able to do this. But at the same time, if you know information that's critical to the United States and there's no reason not to disclose it, it may have made sense for him to come out with it then.
And the president apparently was knowing that this was going to be worse than he was saying. And he was pretty much talking down masks, at least for the first months of this, and continues as of, you know, this weekend to hold rallies where a lot of people are not wearing masks. He went to Nevada for an indoor rally and got into a tiff with the governor there over vastly exceeding the 50-person limit to such gatherings that the governor has ordered in Nevada. What should people make of that? That the president is still at least perceived pretty widely as someone who is just not big on that mask thing.
I mean, there was another example, an event the president was holding where I think it was a New York Times reporter was tweeting out photos of people who weren't wearing masks, and mm-hmm. this reporter was escorted out of the event. Look, I mean, you can't have it both ways, Mr. President. You can't say you're leading the country on this. You can't say that you know that this virus spreads in an airborne way. And now that the science has shown that masks are effective, not to be able to abide by that simply because you want to show your defiance of the establishment, defiance of the norms, to show your voters and supporters that, you know, you're a renegade, that you're going to stick your thumb in the eye of people. I mean, look, let's face it, that's just not responsible behavior. So, you know, there are people who are worried right now that this event in Nevada last night could be one of those super spreader events. You're indoors. People are packed together. They're shouting. They're, you know, these little droplets are coming out of their mouth. Who knows how many people do get sick from this? There is evidence from that South Dakota motorcycle rally that there are people all over the country who have gotten sick because of that. So, look, it doesn't take much to be able to ask people to wear masks and to serve as a role model and still rouse your supporters and get them energized. You can do that without jeopardizing people's health. So I think that just sends a very, very, you know, wrong message to the American people at this moment in time. There is no point in jeopardizing people's health, even if the president can claim that he's moving our country quickly toward a vaccine to be able to address this. You just don't want to risk lives, even if it's for a political event. Look, even if he had held an event where people were close together, shoulder to shoulder, but encouraged everybody to wear masks or told everyone to wear masks, they probably would have listened to him and still would have been standing up and cheering for the president at that rally. Why he didn't do that, you have to ask him.
One last thing. The Republican nomination that Thursday night a couple of weeks ago now, a little more than a couple of weeks ago, in Washington, outside the White House there, big shoulder-to-shoulder crowd, not wearing masks. I'm not hearing much about any outbreaks from that. Are you?
No, I'm not. You have to imagine that people there were very well tested. I mean, the White House in particular has been very, very strong about making sure that, you know, nobody gains access without being tested. But here's the other thing. Look, you have outside events, okay, are still problematic if people are face-to-face, mm-hmm. talking over loud music, shouting each other's faces without wearing masks. But outside events are far better than indoor events. And, you know, you did see any number of people from that Tulsa rally earlier this year who did get sick. You had Secret Service. You had part of the president's advance team were getting sick. You had the passing of a former presidential candidate, Herman Cain, is arguably from that rally. So it's those indoor rallies that are the most worrisome, even though you still want to take as many precautions as possible outside. You know, you can't stop people from living. That's why restaurants are trying to do their best to allow people to eat outside. So you can't stop people from living, but you got to take the precautions. And for sure, when you're having an indoor event, where people are loud and people are shouting and people are sweating and close to each other, that's where you should be wearing masks. But yeah, I don't think that there have been any or many reports of from the White House. But again, the White House really is probably one of the safest places to be right now. And even when it was so safe to be there, you still had a few people in the White House who came down with the coronavirus. So I don't hold it against the president or any candidate for wanting to hold rallies with voters. This is a campaign. This is an election. You want to meet with people. You want to feel their energy. But take precautions, because there's no point in potentially infecting those people who are there or having them get infected and infect other people in their homes and their communities. You know, you don't need to do that to hold a nice rally.
All right. Well, Leonard Steinhorn of CBS News, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks, as always. Thank you.
Let's go to a listener calling. I believe Michael from Waitsfield is on the line. Michael?
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
So, I'm doing great. Looking at the foliage coming a little bit more every day. But
yep.
Anyway, I find it very interesting whenever I speak to voters about the teacher-in-chief, and I ask them this question, that what in the 74-year record of Donald Trump would you want your child or any child to study, learn, and follow in order to have a value-filled, content life? And don't tell me that he's president or does not drink. And if you have no answer to that, and since one of the most important part of a president that's any age, but especially 74 years old, is to transfer values to the future generation, and you have no answer, how could you possibly vote for this person to be president of the United States or leader of the free world? And nobody has an answer of anything that they want their child to learn from Donald Trump. Not one person.
Let me try to. I'm just going to play the devil's advocate for a minute with you, Michael, and say, here's a value I hope my kid grows up with, and that is the ability to question the establishment, to thumb your nose at the elites, to recognize that even experts are not all knowing, all that sort of stuff. You know, I'm not saying.
Okay.
That's necessarily where I come from, but I'm just imagine somebody saying that.
Yeah, but it's
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But you can't. Right, they cannot point that out based on his almost, you know, what is public of a 74-year record, because his 74 record, you cannot trust one word that he says in anything before he ever thought about being president, when he was still a single person, and through his family life. And the fact that he says that he had nothing to do with bringing up his children, and there is no value that I have ever heard or anybody has ever pointed out to me that they want their child to learn.
So
I think that's the answer right there. You don't have to discuss the rest of politics. If it's nothing in about the person that you want your child to learn, who needs him?
I get what you're saying, and I also want to sort of reply to my own comment a moment ago, wherein, you know, and you kind of make this point, but I want to zero it in. There's so much dishonesty. I don't know what's not elitist about having a private airplane with gold bathroom fixtures on it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is what I understand Donald Trump had. I don't know if he still does.
David, we all know plenty of wealthy people. But here's a person that he doesn't even know how to handle wealth. So that's all I have to say. So I can't. I really don't understand how he has this much support when you think of it between your own values and what you want your children and grandchildren to learn. So that's my story.
Yeah,
thank you for listening.
I read something the other day where the secret of his support was described as. Basically, he is the thumb that people are sticking in the eye of the intelligentsia, the coastal elites, whatever you want to call them. And he's actually the instrument of this anger, and has managed to fashion himself to be so, even though he comes from a very coastal place, New York City, you know, obviously a big port city. And he is very, very wealthy, or at least by average standards. So the idea that he's not close to a lead himself, kind of confusing. Michael, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Glad to say my next guest is Tabitha Pullen Moore. She is founder of the Rutland County area chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. And she has been involved in a lot of the racial justice activism that has been burgeoning in Vermont and elsewhere in the United States in recent months. And unfortunately, she has been taking some abuse and harassment because of these activities. And wanted to talk with Tabitha Moore about that. I believe she's on the phone with us. Good morning, Tabitha.
Good morning, Dave. It's good to hear your voice.
Good to hear you, too. And I saw the some recent news coverage about your situation, and do I understand it correctly that you have made a decision that you are going to be moving from where you've been living for, I think, 13 years or something like that?
Yes, I am moving.
And has that move happened already, or are you still working on it? Or
I'm still working on it. I have a safety plan, you know, if we needed to leave, you know, this very minute, which is fantastic. I had a lot of folks offer housing support, which has been wonderful. So I am just trying to tie up some ends here, and
yeah,
including finding a more permanent place for my family and I to live.
And you grew up in Rutland County, is that right?
I did. I actually I moved back in 2009 to the area. I graduated in 1996 and came back 13 years later to, you know, try to increase visibility and voice for people in marginalized positions. So.
And of course, Vermont state officials and anybody who studies the demographic issues we've had in the state probably love the idea of somebody who maybe moves away from Vermont to see some of the larger world early on and then comes back still as a young person and able to contribute a lot to through her working life and then have children in the schools and be a part of the Vermont community and economy and all of that sort of good stuff. It sounds like you have been on that path pretty much. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, like I love Vermont. Growing up here, you know, I had a wonderful childhood experience in a lot of different ways. The one thing that was really hard was the racism back in the day. And so, you know, I went out and saw the world and learned a lot more that I didn't know. And I wanted to bring that home. And like I said, try to make the place more welcoming and safer for people in all kinds of marginalized positions. And starting the branch of the NAACP was an important part of that. I think as a state that depends on tourism as our major economy, you know, our main economic source, I thought it was really important that people understood the connection between people wanting to come and spend money here and the ways that we treat people when they are here. And there's been so many incidents from people coming and trying to stay and live, people coming, you know, remember the camp at Stowe with the young people, a whole bunch of campers that ended up having to leave because of the racial slurs they faced. My hope was to be able to do something about that.
Yeah. A little more on your own biography. You went to high school where did you go to high school? There in Rutland County somewhere?
Yeah. I attended Mill River Union High School, Go Minutemen.
Okay.
And I came back in 2009 and was a school counselor there for about 8.5 years, trying to do similar work in the schools. And faced, you know, some pretty significant just issues related to the work.
That's got to be kind of cool when you grow up attending a school and then you end up being on the, I guess in this case, the guidance staff, but or the faculty or whatever, at the same school you attended yourself. I mean, it must be, I'm sure that's not an unheard of circumstance that occasionally teachers are teaching at the school they attended, but it's still got to be interesting. How would you say, How would you say the racial climate has changed, if at all, or if it's still the same, maybe, from the time you were? I mean, I gather you graduated you graduated high school in 96, or?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
You know, it was. What's changed is I think technology has allowed people more access to different cultures and societies and more information than was previously available. And I think that that has certainly helped to create a more multicultural kind of idea in people's heads here. It was nice when I came back, I saw, you know, more brown and black faces at first. And so, it's pretty hopeful about that. But I'm finding that the more people are aware of racism and how it manifests, and the more educated the general majority are becoming about the ways that they see it and starting to speak up, the more pushback there is from people who would consider themselves to be not racist. And so I think what we're seeing right now is that people who are armed with information, who are with good information, I should say, from valid resources and sites, are trying to do really important work. At the same time, there are a number of folks and a number of news outlets who perpetuate false information and false narratives, and they are just as passionate and mobilized as well. So we're seeing this massive conflict over basic human rights that I'm not sure would look this way if we didn't have access to information in the ways that we do. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword.
So I want to get into a little bit of this summer's story with you. We need to go to a bottom-of-the-hour break, though, in just a couple of minutes, so I think I might save it for after the break. But in the meantime, I wanted to ask you, do you feel as though overall the situation is improved from 1996, or are we still, or has it worsened, or what's your sense there?
I'm still hearing a lot of the same stories that I experienced as a child, and right now the growing racial tension in this state is pretty awful. It's just like it is around the rest of the U.S. So I wouldn't say it's getting better, but it's the scab's been picked off, and we're bleeding out right now, I think, as a state and as a nation.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose that is something which is going to happen, maybe. I don't know if there's any way to avoid it.
Right. I think
is it part of a natural cycle of history?
It seems to be part of the natural cycle of history. It also is part of the cycle of civil resistance to oppressive regime, which is what, you know, racism is. And so as people are starting to band together and push back, we're starting to see far more incidents of discrimination and violence and hate, far beyond, you know, even what I'm experiencing.
Just a minute ago, what are some of the things you are experiencing?
Right. I'm trying not to go into too much detail about things because it's been kind of a rough summer. And my kids are listening, but I have, you know, starting the NAACP, I knew that there was going to be some level of pushback, but the level of vitriol and hate and some of the messages and the emails and the thinly veiled threats that I receive are getting to be beyond tenable. Then there was my daughter who advocated to raise the Black Lives Matter flag in our school district, who has been attacked by adults on social media. I had a horrible incident with a neighbor who did some pretty awful things.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but let's talk more about this after the break. We got to get some CBS News in, a couple words from our sponsors, and we're going to continue our conversation with Tabitha Moore just on the other side. We'll be back very shortly, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. practicing all safe protocols, masks required.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
My guest is Tabitha Moore. She is a founder of the Rutland NAACP chapter, and she is someone who's been involved in racial justice activism here in Vermont. You were telling us a little bit about some of the harassment you have experienced this summer, Tabitha, and your daughter's work at the school. Let's get back to that story.
I'd say that's probably the tipping point for me. Since I'd say June, I think, like, for me personally, I've received far more threatening, harassing pieces of correspondence. But I think the tipping point was for me when my 17-year-old successfully worked with the school board to get them to raise the Black Lives Matter flag. And the district even decided that they should add the gay pride flag to that. And immediately the hate started rolling in. And this is, you know, social media based for the majority. I mean, people calling a 17-year-old, like grown folks, picking on a 17-year-old, saying hateful vitriolic things, about a child who actually is working in her summer to do something important for our community. At that point, I kind of realized that I needed to take stock of what's going on for my family and see the ways that the work that I'm doing is having an impact, because I know that part of the hate that she received, and even saw some of the messages, and some of the messages, you know, was directed at me. And so, you know, as I was taking account of what was happening and more of these things are rolling in, and I have to deal with my neighbor, and then, you know, it's just, I just realized that this is not a healthy way for me to be in this, and that I don't need to hurt myself or my family. We don't need to be harmed in the process of doing this. So
obviously,
I decided to reposition. You know, it's been a tough summer. Lots of anxiety and sleepless nights. For me and for my kids and my kid's dad, my ex-husband, has been fairly stressed as well through this process and trying to make sure he's supporting and doing what he can.
And so you are contemplating a move, actually, planning a move, I guess, and your daughter is just starting her senior year at Mill River, right?
Yes, I'm trying not to go into too much detail about what that looks like for her. I'm still trying I don't want to give away a ton of information about what she's really doing this year, but yes.
Okay. I know that in many circumstances that's a very tough time to move, is when, you know, when a kid is just late in the high school years, obviously has grown up with a certain community and would be in happier circumstances, I'm sure, eager to graduate with their class and all that good stuff.
She will still graduate. Yeah, she'll still graduate from Mill River. And but she also recognizes the importance of safety. And her better than, you know, 99% of people understand why it's so important. And she's actually very much looking forward to relocating.
Yeah.
Wow. She knows what to,
your work with the NAACP in the Rutland area. You're the founder of the local chapter there. Is that right?
That's correct.
And do you think that activism in and of itself is some of what prompted some of the hatred to come out?
Oh, that's absolutely what it is. You know, whenever you speak out about injustice, whenever you make people in the majority uncomfortable about the ways that our society is harming folks, you know, like I said, you've got to expect a degree of pushback. But what I'm seeing here is just, it's just untenable. It's not, you know, it's not something that people should have to put up with. You know, you expect the occasional comment like, you know, you don't know what real racism is, or there's no racism here. But when people get into some very specific epithets and, like I said, veiled threats, it reaches another level, and there's no reason for it toward me or my child or anyone in my family. Other family members are now being dragged into things by people, you know, just looking for a fight. And I'm not interested in fighting. My whole point in doing this is to help racial inequity end peacefully, because it's going to end one way or another. And as we're seeing, it's going to get more violent. So until and unless people, not just around Vermont, but white folks in general, really start to understand the ways that systemic racism, white supremacy are embedded in our society and start to pay attention to that, if they don't do that, this will not end peacefully, but it will end. So I'm just so worried for, you know, I'm just so worried, you know.
Yeah.
And the more threats I see, the more, you know, hateful rhetoric I see, even coming from legislators or people that are running for office across the state. It's just, I wish I could say it's unbelievable, the level of just ignorance and hate that people harbor. But it's not. It's a matter of working to undo it and understand. That would teach something different.
This isn't your responsibility, certainly, but I sort of wonder, what do you say to somebody who is coming to you and making a comment reflecting, you know, real hatred or at least strong annoyance at being challenged at all to change one's thinking here? What first off, let's think of an example of what somebody might say to indicate, you know, they are having a lot of trouble with this stuff.
Well, one of the things, you know, let's go with a mild version, which is, you know, this wouldn't be a problem if you weren't bringing it up. You know, and I kind of want to challenge your idea. I actually think it's all of our responsibilities when we hear hateful rhetoric or pushback against opening our eyes. It is our job collectively. I don't get paid for the NAACP. I do it as a labor of love because it's really critical to me that that we understand and work toward a more equitable society. So when somebody says something like, this isn't a real problem here, you know, it wouldn't be an issue if you didn't bring it up, to lean into that and to be curious, like, tell me more about where you're coming from with that. Where are you getting your information? Are you even using reliable sources? The number of people, just with those three questions alone, whose arguments are just completely dead in the water, is amazing. When it comes to, that's one example. I should stop there. Did you want more, or is that?
Well, I guess so you ask them where they get their information, and they don't really have much to tell you. And so, is there any way to kind of change their thinking? You know, I don't think the conversation has really caused the person you're speaking to change anything about his or her thinking or views or even likelihood that they're going to continue to say stuff like this.
Right.
Is there any way to move that?
So there's interpersonal and then there's systemic, right? And if we're talking about change on the interpersonal level, like you and I are sitting down having a conversation and you say something like that, and, you know, I get curious. I just ask more questions. Like, where are you getting your information? Like, where did you learn that? Like, you know, those sorts of things. Then it becomes curiosity about, you know, are you interested in learning something more? Do you want to know something different, or is it more important to you to hold on to false ideology? And figuring out if they're even that level of aware of their learning process. I find that, you know, most people haven't even stopped to think about it in Vermont because they don't have to. So making them aware of the fact that learning is not just a passive process, that they have to be actively engaged in learning, and then inviting them, are you interested in learning this? So that's on the individual level, because I have no time. If somebody says to me, you know, like, hey, Tabitha, let's go out to lunch so I can tell you why you're wrong, which has happened to me. in the last month. Jeez. Somebody's like, I'd like to invite you out to lunch and tell you why the pride flag is wrong. And I'm like, no. First of all, it's not an enjoyable meal. And second of all, I have no interest in being spewed more hateful ideology. I know why you think the pride flag is wrong. You've told me you think it's perverse. You've told me that gay people, perversion and what they do, like all of the different rhetoric that they've never put on heterosexual people. So when I hear that kind of thing, I'm not interested. On a systemic level, and that's a lot of what I do with the NAACP, is pointing out the ways that systems perpetuate inequities, whether that's through data collection or more storytelling or gathering information about people's lived experiences here to help flesh out the picture for people who make decisions. On a systemic level, it's about pointing out the patterns and making people aware of the history. Rarely do you hear somebody in Vermont, I should say, although there are some legislators and even locally here in Rutland, some people with some pretty awful and just totally misguided and potentially hateful beliefs that are leading us. But from a systemic perspective, it's a matter of, okay, let's look at the info here. And is this the state we want to be? And pushing for legislation and policies and procedures that are more equitable.
When you hear from, officials around the Rutland area stuff that, what kind of stuff is being said that indicates to you that there's a real problem even among our elected officials and so on?
Okay, so there is, I don't know if you've seen it, but I'm trying to pull it up now while we're talking, but a number of people here, including the postmaster, the mayor, several members of the select board, in Rutland, and then, here in Wallingford, we even had an incident with a select board member calling two youth. She's attacking children, calling them little girls, which is so wrapped in misogyny and, all kinds of horrible things. But we have a number of their social media posts where they are ranting and raving in very racist and harmful ways. One person, the mayor, even posted intentionally derogatory post of Larry Bird, I think it was maybe a few weeks ago, when folks in the NBA decided to protest. But somebody put together a website with all of the things that they've been posting lately. You have Tom DePoy on the select board, on the board of aldermen, talking about, we don't need implicit bias training. That's, it's absolutely ridiculous. We don't need this. And then vehemently the next week, turning around on his heels, him and the rest of the select board, not the rest of them, but the rest of the board of aldermen, with a few exceptions, talking about how they need to be a big part of, and they should be leading this fight or having a say in the Rutland Raider mascot change, which is a school board level decision. And it's based on race and racism. So you have all of these contradictions, like racism isn't a thing. We don't need to spend any time on it. But when it comes to our mascot, hey, we're gonna go across the boundaries of what has been set up to govern our systems, our school system, and our select board, because we're personally offended and hurt by this. So there's a lot of contradiction and a lot of just hateful information that's being perpetrated by our officials across Rutland, the Rutland area, and not just the Rutland area, but across Vermont.
Do you feel like that the state administration, Governor Scott, and his people have this stuff pretty right, or are there problems there too, or what's your sense?
Well, I think there's problems everywhere, and it's just a matter of whether or not we're aware of them and the ways that we're perpetrating them. What I will say is I've worked with Governor Scott's administration on a number of initiatives, and they have been open and willing to hear and willing to work and to learn something new because they know they're not experts. And so they're willing to turn to the people who are experts in their own experiences as well as understanding how systemic racism works. And so the Scott administration has been willing to engage those things, as you see from like the Racial Equity Task Force, for example. So they're willing to acknowledge in ways that, are nonpartisan, which, the NAACP is the nation's oldest nonpartisan civil rights organization. The reason we're nonpartisan is because racism has become a politicized issue. Apologies. My dog's upset about something.
racism, all manners of social inequities have become politicized. And, you know, one of the first things you hear out of people's mouths is, you know, well, why are you raising a political flag? Or, you know, a flag of, you know, a group with a political agenda. And there's so much to deconstruct in that. First of all, there's the Black Lives Matter movement versus the Black Lives Matter organization, not versus, but, you know, two different entities. There's just so much misinformation and intentional kind of red herring happening in anti-progress movements. But it's a lot to take on. And so having people like Governor Scott and his administration being willing to listen is a critical component to changing this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's a lot of lumping together that's going on here, where I see letters to the editor and other stuff arguing that Black Lives Matter folks are all Marxists and so on. And you know, one thing that I think is worth saying is that under our First Amendment, in the United States of America, you're actually allowed to be a Marxist if you want. If you want to espouse the economic theories of Karl Marx and think that they should be applied to, you know, the way our government operates and relates to the economy and so on and so forth, you are allowed to say that stuff. And so when somebody says, oh my word, such and such is Marxist, I kind of go, well, so, you know, other people aren't.
Well, anyway. One of the first questions I ask people when they say that is, like, what do you understand Marxism to be? Have you read the Communist Manifesto? Do you actually understand what it's saying? I want to understand that about you, because I need to understand where you're coming from in order to meet somewhere with you, which is a huge part of the process. But, I mean, you know, we kind of digress a bit. But, yeah. I mean, a lot of the hate mail I get, which is, you know, kind of ironic, is that, you know, the NAACP is, like I said, we're the oldest. We've been around over 110 years, 111 years, actually. And people are like, oh, you know, you F you NAACP, black supremacist B, you that run the BLM. I'm like, no, Black Lives Matter and the NAACP are completely different organizations. You know, we're all part of the same movement. But, you know, that just shows you how completely just out of touch people are. And they have no idea. Some of them know exactly what they're doing, and they're doing it intentionally. And those are the people that worry me.
Tabitha, I'm wondering, do you have any thoughts about a specific legislative agenda or other policy changes that you would like to see in Vermont to try to combat systemic racism in our society?
There's a lot of legislative items that I think need to be addressed, and one of those is even the procedures that the legislature uses to make laws. I think at this point, it's pretty clear that, especially now in the time of COVID, we've seen how easy it is for us to make committee meetings accessible to the public in ways that, you know, they previously haven't been. And so my first thing is, you know, should we be looking at how we even do legislation in Vermont based on technology, and the goal is to maximize community participation and information related to what's going on in the legislature. So that's thing number one for me, is should we even be looking at this process? Because if you talk to any legislator, they'll tell you that this is, you know, it's an arduous process right now. It's a lot of rush, and not enough information, not enough time. It's untenable for everyone. I mean, in the way that we do our legislative session doesn't necessarily work for people who, you know, are who work full-time, right? So if you want to talk about who can even participate in the Vermont legislature based on, you know, the way that we currently operate, you're leaving out lots of different people. And so do we want to reimagine how we do that? Can we even do that? But I think it's time for us to think outside of the box as far as that goes. That being said, I do think that legislatively there are a lot of areas where we can be focusing on, you know, racial equity and injustice. The Racial Equity Task Force actually came from a meeting with myself, Stefan Gillum, who is the president of the Windham Area branch of the NAACP, and the governor, a couple of years ago on the heels of what happened to Kaya Morrison. And one of the things that we talked about was how we need to look at government operations in the ways that, or not even just government operations, but, you know, how do we define hate crime? How do we define hate speech? How do we define harassment? Because as technology updates, as people become more savvy, the tactics are changing. And so do we need to be reexamining that and redefining that? And so, you know, a group of folks have been selected, but because of COVID, the tasks have changed for that group. The mandate for that group has changed. But I still want to get back to how our legislature works, how our government systems are operating, and whether or not those maximize participation, not just by Black and Brown people, but by, you know, by all people in Vermont, in how Vermont is governed.
Well, I'm sure the list continues, but unfortunately we're about out of time for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. Tabitha Moore, I really appreciate you taking some time with us this morning. I think your activism is a welcome thing in Vermont, and I laud you for that. Let's call it a day, though, on this edition of the Dave Graham Show. Thank you very much, Tabitha. We will have another Dave Graham Show on tomorrow morning about 9 o'clock on WDEV FM and AM. Meanwhile, stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. Keep those masks up and the social distancing, and stay healthy, everybody. Talk to you.